morning, everyone. Meeting will come to order. Clerk will note the roll. There is a quorum. We have the minutes of March 14th before us. Are there any corrections, additions, changes? Representative Carlson moves approval of the minutes. See no discussion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Not. Motion prevails. The minutes are approved. Members, first of all, Representative Nornes, happy birthday, I understand.
That was supposed to be a secret, Mr. Chair.
Well, we won't ask you how old you are. All right. What's that? Oh, he won't tell you anyway. All right. Okay. Well, members, a couple of items today. Just let me make sure everyone understands the order and the plan here. We're going to have a presentation of the governor's supplemental budget, and I believe also talk some about the debt capacity report. Then later this morning, we're going to have Representative Neuberger's bill, House File 333. Then it's my expectation that we will recess until after session, and then sometime late afternoon or early evening, we'll listen for an announcement on the floor, take up the Real ID bill. It's my understanding that Real ID is maybe going to pass in the Senate, and if that's the case, we can process it on the floor today and send the Senate file to this committee and then pick it up at that point. So the plan is that we will, after hearing Representative Neuberger's bill and the governor's supplemental budget, recess until likely early this evening, where we will take up the Real ID bill. Any questions on any of that?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Carlson.
For scheduling purposes, what do you mean by early evening, after session, or?
Well, I guess to be honest, Representative Carlson, I'm not really sure how, what is on the calendar for the session today. If it was a short session, maybe we would try to take it up and do it right afterwards. If it's runs longer for some reason, if it runs till, I don't know, 5:30 for whatever reason, something like that, I guess then I think I'd want to give people a dinner break and take up Real ID afterwards. So I guess it's a little dependent on what happens on floor today. I guess I want to be respectful of everyone's schedule. If people want to get home early, I want to be respectful of that too, but I also want to give people a chance for dinner. So please listen on the floor. I'll make an announcement. All right. See no other questions. Welcome to the committee. Back to the committee, Commissioner Franz, Budget Director Kelly. Can you take us through the governor's supplemental budget recommendation?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. Thank you for making the invitation for us to join you today. What I'd like to do is talk to you a little bit about the broad categories of the budget and outline the overall budget strategy that the governor implemented or is recommending for this session. For the record, my name is Myron Franz, Commissioner of Minnesota Management and Budget, and with me is Budget Director Margaret Kelly. As we all know, we've faced a series of deficits for many years, and lately we've had a string of surpluses that we've been able to work with. And what I'd like to go through now is to talk about some of the key areas, and then I'll break down the numbers a little bit, and we can talk a little bit more about the numbers. But first of all, the governor, we believe, has proposed a fiscally responsible budget that would protect Minnesota's financial future while making some critical investments in the economy that we think will help make it more more opportunities for all Minnesotans to participate. Governor Dayton, as he mentioned in the State of the State, his number one priority that he highlighted then is to protect the fiscal integrity of the state. We believe this budget accomplishes that, along with making some key investments in Minnesota's children, in Minnesota families and communities, and critical investments in state government. The governor is recommending $698 million of adjustments to the current biennial budget for the general fund. To ensure the financial stability of the state, $411 million of these investments are one-time spending items in the governor's budget recommendations. The governor's recommendations would leave $202 million on the bottom line for this biennium and an additional $369 million for the next biennium. The result is that he is recommending leaving $571 million on the bottom line to protect against future economic uncertainty. Adding the $1.6 billion currently in the state's budget reserve would give us over $2 billion in available assets, not counting the $350 million in the cash account. I'd like to first of all talk about the early education and early learning area. There are about $77 million of additional investments in this area. Governor Dayton and Lieutenant Governor Smith are proposing targeted new investments in Minnesota's kids, families, and communities to help narrow the state's achievement gap, to ensure that more Minnesota kids are ready for kindergarten, to save families tens of thousands of dollars on child care costs, and to help prepare more kids across Minnesota to access greater opportunities. First of all, the governor is proposing a $25 million investment to move Minnesota closer to voluntary pre-kindergarten for all Minnesota families everywhere in Minnesota. This proposal would make quality, affordable early learning available to 3,700 more Minnesota four-year-olds. This optional preschool program, combined with existing preschool scholarships that serve about 5,600 children, would help ensure about 12.6% of Minnesota four-year-olds are enrolled in a quality early learning program, setting them up for success in school and in life. Another area that the governor wants to direct his budget toward is alleviating Minnesota's teacher shortage. Each year, Minnesota schools lose about 5,800 teachers to retirement, to other states, and to career changes. And right now, our state isn't producing enough new teachers to fill that gap. This problem is particularly acute in greater Minnesota communities that are attempting to fill open positions in science and math. Similarly, Minnesota's teacher workforce does not reflect the growing diversity of our state. Only about 3.8% of teachers are people of color, while 30% of their students are children of color. These teachers play important roles in closing the achievement gap, serving as cultural mediators, advocates, and role models. To develop a diverse and robust teacher workforce, Governor Dayton and Lieutenant Governor Smith have proposed $12.4 million to help train and attract up to 1,200 teacher candidates each year. The next area is family home visiting. Minnesota teenagers gave birth to 2,700 children in 2014. These new parents often lack family support, high school diplomas, and parenting skills. To help teen parents and their newborns get off to a strong start, the governor and lieutenant governor are proposing $10.7 million in new investments to the Department of Health's highly effective home visiting program. This helps the parents of at-risk children develop the skills they need to care for their children. Economists have found that home visiting programs can return $5.70 for every dollar invested by increasing graduation rates, decreasing incarceration rates, improving school readiness, and supporting children's health in general. The proposal also will improve access to evidence-based home visiting for all high-risk mothers by increasing medical assistance payments for these services. Another area is child care assistance. You are all familiar with Minnesota's Child Care Assistance Program, which provides financial assistance to help low-income families pay for child care. This assistance makes a profound difference for parents and their children, allowing parents to pursue educational work while helping Minnesota kids access high-quality child care. Governor Dayton, Lieutenant Governor Smith's proposal would invest $28.3 million in this initiative with additional resources in future years to increase. We would increase provider payment rates and also remove red tape for families and providers. These investments will result in more stable assistance for families and increase the number of child care providers who can participate in the program, improving the care for more than 30,000 children of low-income parents. In the higher education area, the governor's proposal...
Let me interrupt you there if I can, Commissioner. I think maybe the best way to go about this as you go through the budget is, as we kind of move from subject to subject, I guess I'd offer the chance for members to ask questions. And, you know, we're kind of leaving the one slide and the one subject and going into higher education. I want to see if anyone's got any questions here. And if no members do, I do. Representative Wagenius.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the opportunity. When you said the voluntary pre-K and the dollar amount, did I hear, and I'm not sure I heard correctly, but did that mean that in that 12% of the children at 4-year-olds would be served and that 88% would not be served?
Commissioner Franz.
Mr. Chair, Representative, by combining the additional $25 million investment here and with some of the existing preschool scholarships, mm-hmm. that would bring us up to about 12.6%. So, yes, the remaining children, although they are participating in some schools, some school programs, this would be the number of percent of children that would be serviced by these programs.
Representative Guinness.
Well, I appreciated the governor's all-day preschool program and probably understand why you didn't put that on the table now, but I'm asking if you considered funding schools with, say, 50% free and reduced lunch, or where the children would be 50% free and reduced lunch, or 75% free and reduced lunch. Was that a possibility that was considered?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I can say pretty unequivocally that the governor's number one priority has always been early education. And one of the reasons that he scaled back some of his proposals in this particular budget was out of recognition that the balance available and for this biennium and the next biennium required some careful thought and some careful targeting to make sure we take the next steps and we continue to push for these programs. There were a lot of different discussions that we had about different programs and how they might be most effective. And so I think at this point what I can say is the governor is trying to target his investments in a way that are really specific to what the resources we have available in this biennium.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I think Representative Guinness raises a good point. And years ago, Representative Guinness and I worked on the issue of all-day kindergarten. And if you'll remember, we targeted those dollars because just like now, we had limited dollars. In fact, they were so limited, I think we could only fund 50 sites initially. But it grew from there until finally a few years ago we made it universal. But it was based on free and reduced lunch. That was the decision because we thought that those students were the ones in greatest need. And we did have a formula to make sure that it was spread around the state. The formula provided that a certain percentage of the dollars went to the cities of the first class, a certain percentage of the dollars went to suburban districts, which also had some free and reduced lunch concentrations, and then to greater Minnesota. So we made sure that it was spread around the state with those limited dollars, but we did focus on free and reduced lunch. And then the Department of Education gave us a list. They had a list that was available that would provide where those school sites were that were, in that case, initially the top 50 with free and reduced lunch. I didn't mean to get us too much into the weeds on that, but I think with limited dollars, you really have to look at a way. We've got the chair of the committee across from me there of making sure those dollars go where the greatest need is when we're limiting it to just the $25
million. Representative, I have Representative Erdahl, unless you have a follow-up for that, Representative Guinness.
I do, if I could.
Sure, go ahead.
The way we did that, dividing it evenly, was literally a third to the cities of the first class, a third to the suburban cities, and a third to outstate Minnesota. You could actually this year do a formula that would be different and have it go more to outstate Minnesota, because actually when you do the numbers now, there are more children in free and reduced lunch in outstate Minnesota than there are in the cities of the first class. That's a surprising number, but it's true. I did do a run on that, or Tim Strom did. I couldn't possibly do it, but Tim Strom can do miracles. Did a run on that, and if anybody is interested in looking at it, I'd be glad to share it.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I just might add that, to your point, the funding for the targeted investment for early pre-K or pre-K would be based on poverty rates, which obviously take into account free and reduced lunches, and also the lack of 3- and 4-star parent-aware programs. Because as you mentioned, Representative, in greater Minnesota, there's particularly difficulty in finding some of these programs. So this would, we believe, would make the disbursement of this both geographically well based around the state and also priority authorized as well. Thank you.
And I know I have you on the list, Representative Erdahl, but Chair Loon, since your name was kind of brought up in this, do you have something that you wanted to respond to? I see you've gone on the list, too.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate it. And just if I could follow up, I know that we'll be waiting for the legislative language to fill in some of the details on this, but just a question on this proposal. I know it's, as you mentioned, for areas that don't have a perhaps a robust variety of 3- and 4-star rated parent-aware rated early childhood facilities and areas, high concentrations of poverty. Is the funding, as I understand it, would be for voluntary pre-K, but for a half-day program with funding of per pupils at a 0.6 level, so just over half a pupil, which gets into the weeds on education funding. But would any of the money be available for use for transportation, for facilities, for other things that may be necessary to providing this?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, well, thank you for those comments and questions. I think one of the things that we've wanted to do in the bonding bill, we put about $20 million in investments, both cash and bonding money, to help schools around the state deal with the structural issue that some schools are not prepared in terms of having facilities available. So that would be one way that would help in that area. And we are working on the bill language, as you mentioned, which will be out shortly. And also in the transportation area, I'm not aware of any transport. I don't think there's any transportation dollars per se at this point.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Commissioner Franz, just a comment. First, I don't want to suggest that these things aren't important. I think that they all are. But in conversations with superintendents in my greater Minnesota district, we still have some schools that are in financial stress, and they feel that any supplemental money could be better spent, I think, on the formula for them. So just making that comment that we do have school districts still having some problems, and that the money on the formula would be very appreciative.
Commissioner, I guess if I can ask about this teacher development and evaluation initiative for, I think it's listed on here, $10 million. I thought it was more like 11 or 12. But anyway, I guess, is the governor recommending anything in regard to the Board of Teaching? You know, this issue has been around with us for a couple years in terms of discussion about whether the Board of Teaching is applying their standards in a consistent manner, if maybe they're too strict in not allowing qualified teachers from other states to move here. We had the Office of Legislative Auditor issue a report here not long ago suggesting that the Board of Teaching and the Department of Education should perhaps be combined, and talking about problems in that area. I mean, I guess, what else is the governor proposing in this area besides just more money, and why would we propose more money as opposed to looking at trying to do something more with the current system that generally people seem to think is not working very well?
Mr. Chair, I think there are a number of responses to that. First of all, the governor and the Commissioner Casilius will obviously present more detail about this, but clearly are committed to providing resources. We believe there is a resource problem in the sense that there aren't enough opportunities for new people to enter into the teaching field. You know, clearly there are some issues that that we can also talk about in terms of how well the licensing process works. I think those are good discussions that we can have. If we can make some fixes and make that work better, that certainly is understandable. But I think, in our view, there is a need to drastically provide some new resources here, because we're falling behind in the teachers that we have available, and teacher helpers. It's not just teachers, but it's classroom assistants as well. So clearly we can delve more into detail about some of the policy changes, but we do believe a resource is important at this point.
Okay, and then, Commissioner, on the family home visiting piece, I'm looking for my data on it. I want to say I think that is supposed to provide, serve an additional 4,100 families each year. How many families are we serving with this right now?
Mr. Chair, I don't have that number in front of me. I'm sorry.
All right. Okay. Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Commissioner Franz. Do you have any idea how many students, in terms of the pre-K age group, we're talking about four-year-olds, that currently are in programs, whether they're private or in schools? I know the school districts that I represent all have programs for this age group, but how many are involved statewide that are in programs right now? I know the people that have talked to me, they like the grant program, they like the scholarship, so they can send, the parents can send their students, their kids, wherever they want to. But how many number do we have in the state that are currently in a program?
Commissioner Franz.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't have those numbers in front of me, but one of the concerns we have is that there are a number of families around the state that don't have really good options, that do want to put their children or four-year-olds into some kind of program, but those simply are not available either in the school or in the community. So one of the issues certainly for expanding the voluntary pre-K program around the state is to make those more available to more families. But I don't have the numbers in front of me about how many are actually involved in pre-K programs.
Thank you. And Commissioner, if I could go finally to the child care assistance rates. In terms of increasing the child care assistance rates, do you have like an average number of what the percentage increase would be in reimbursement? I mean, does this average out to be a 5% increase, a 10% increase? Any idea?
Mr. Chair, one of the issues we were trying to get these reimbursement rates up to was about 50% of the market share. Right now, they're in the, I think, the 30% reimbursement range. And one of the steps we wanted to make, we'd like to go further, but one of the steps we wanted to make this year was to try to get those reimbursement rates up to at least 50%.
So are you saying that this would mean, well, that'd be a pretty big increase. I'm not necessarily saying it's a bad idea, but you're saying that that'd be like a, are you saying that if it's going from a 30% to 50%, well, I guess I can't do the math that way. It doesn't really work that way. Okay. All right. Other questions on the education piece? Representative Liebley.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, talking about this child care assistance piece, you know, just let me add that I think that part of the problem that the governor might be trying to solve here is that there's a tremendous shortage of child care availability in a lot of places, and I guess some people think that's because these rates are just way too low. But I wanted to raise something else. I mean, a number of questions have been asked of the commissioner, and they're very specific questions, and not too surprising to me that he doesn't necessarily have the data to go in depth in all of these things. And I just hope that that the governor's budget will be given hearings in the committees that it pertains to, so that some of these questions really can be asked and we can have a full discussion. Because I know I asked Representative Dean in Health and Human Services Finance if we were going to hear the governor's budget, and he was a little bit iffy about it. We did hear one piece of it, had a great hearing on one important piece, but I think that this certainly deserves to be fully vetted and the ideas exchanged in the committees, and I don't know that we can really do that here because obviously we don't have all the right people, and not only at the witness table but around this table. So I hope that this is not the only opportunity for some of these issues to get aired.
Well, I think, Representative Liebling, that other committees will be having hearings as well, although I understand, too, that the language from the administration for these initiatives is not yet available. So it's a little bit difficult to have, you know, detailed hearings on proposals if there isn't any specific language available for them yet. And I guess I don't expect the commissioner to know everything, almost everything, but not everything. I know he's doing his best to give us the answers that he has, and we appreciate that, and we appreciate him and Budget Director Kelly being here to give us the overview and what answers to questions they can give us. Any other questions on the yes, Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and to Representative Liebling's point, I agree with Representative Liebling 100% that we should be hearing these provisions, and we're starting tomorrow on Tax Committee, and we'll give the commissioners in that area, Commissioner Bowerly, all the time she needs, and we'll have questions from all the members, so we're going to be hearing it as long as it takes to go through the whole bill as far as the tax provisions.
Thank
you. So, for the record, I'm agreeing with Representative Liebling.
All right.
I'm marking that on my calendar.
All right, Commissioner, let's move on to the next section, higher education.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. In the higher education area, the governor is promoting, recommending $21 million a year in ongoing to help ongoing operating costs at the Minnesota State Colleges and University, or the MNSCU system. This additional funding to MNSCU would allow them to maintain their planned tuition rates for the 16-17 school year without reducing their services. This supplemental funding would be distributed directly to the MNSCU 37 separately accredited colleges and universities across Minnesota to fund core operations. No funds would be retained in this system, in the system office, for this particular appropriation. And this continues into the next biennium as well. For the University of Minnesota, the governor is recommending two major investment areas. The first one is a $19 million appropriation for cybersecurity improvements. These improvements at the University of Minnesota are part of a larger scale project that the university is supporting with $78 million of their own funding over the next 3 years, called the Next Generation Network Initiative. We believe that this investment will help improve security throughout this approach, and we believe that it's necessary to prevent security breaches and early detection if an attack occurs. I might just mention as a side point, I'll get to a little bit later, the governor is also recommending a cybersecurity component to his budget for the state operating system as well, and there'll be plenty of opportunity for General Nash and Commissioner Baden to talk about that, but the University of Minnesota also has a request for enhanced security in the IT area. The other area for University of Minnesota are two different healthcare training initiatives, $16 million in total. About $10.5 million would be used to support the medical and dental clinical training, education, and research by the university's Department of Family Medicine and Community Health and the School of Dentistry Mobile Dental Clinic. They have sites in Duluth, Mankato, and St. Cloud. So that $10.5 million would be used to support and enhance that program, and another $5.7 million will be used to increase the number of residents that can be trained each year at the health care clinics that serve low-income patients. This would be an opportunity to create additional training opportunities for dentists that serve in rural Minnesota.
Thank you.
Any questions before we move on?
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Commissioner, could you expand a little bit when you referenced education? What kinds of programs you're talking about there? And the reason I'm asking the question is that, for example, I'm just using this as an example, nursing. MNSCU is a big provider of nurses. You identified that some of them would be going to help with outreach, which is education related, but it's more the practical experience from the standpoint of the university, plus it gives some assistance to low-income families. But were any of those dollars geared toward nursing, for example? Because the big provider of nurses is MNSCU, LPN, RN, and right on down the line.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative, for the MNSCU appropriation recommendation, they were not specifically targeted toward any nursing programs. They were really targeted toward some of the operating costs at the 37 different sites around the state. At the University of Minnesota is where the programs are targeted specifically for both the medical and dental programs for outsourcing those around the state.
Yeah, Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know if it's current, but we did have a nursing shortage. That's the reason I used right. that as an example. And that $21 million, it sounded like that was more to control tuition, which I think is a good thing. But if part of that university appropriation was to help with nursing, my only point is the big provider happens to be the MNSCU system. And I haven't had any conversations, Mr. Chairman, with them to know what their current standing is with the need for funds for nursing.
Commissioner, can I ask you on the University of Minnesota health restoration proposal, the detail I've got on page 50 of the kind of bigger budget pack that we've got says the governor recommends a $10.5 million ongoing appropriation to support medical and dental clinical training, et cetera. That is, I guess, the substitute for work that UCARE was doing. And it says then in the second sentence, UCARE has provided significant annual funding for this work, but has eliminated the support due to loss of its Medicaid services contract. So how much funding was UCARE providing annually? Was there, were they providing $10.5 million? I mean, is this an even trade where they were providing $10.5 million a year that they now can't provide because of the loss of the Medicaid contract, or was it something different than the $10.5 million the governor is recommending?
Mr. Chair, as I understand it, about $9.5 million of the $10.5 million would be used to sort of replace the original, the money previously allocated by UCARE. So I believe that, as I understand the proposal, about a million new dollars would be added, but about 9.5 would be used to replace those dollars.
So you're saying, Commissioner, that right now UCARE had been spending $9.5 million this last year on this?
Mr. Chair, yes.
All right. Thank you. Seeing no further questions on higher education, let's go to the next section. And as you go through these, if there's any way, Commissioner or Budget Director Kelly, that you can note maybe what page it's on in this big 50-page supplemental recommendation list we've got, that would be great, just for purposes of giving people a little bit more clarification.
Mr. Chair, I'd be glad to do that. So as we look at this next slide, we're really looking at two proposals that were presented last year. And if you look at page 41 and 46 in that document of, with 50 pages, that's where you can find more detail about these programs. But
thank you.
As Chair David's mentioned, the tax committee will be dealing with these issues, and many of these issues are already in front in the conference committee now. But the proposal for tax would be the same proposals that the governor utilized last year. He would recommend that we expand the child and dependent care tax credit by $47 million, that would expand it from up to 130,000 families that would benefit from this child dependent care tax credit. The working family credit of $39 million would expand it to reach 275,000 families, and the K-12 expense credit would be expanded to reach about 17,000 families. So this proposal, virtually identical to the one that was proposed last session, and now one addition to the tax proposal would be the federal conformity that has been added to this piece that Chair Davids, I'm sure, is aware of, and that will be talked about in the tax committee and other places. So that's the tax program. It's the other one is transportation, and once again, this is the 2015 transportation proposal is what the governor is recommending. As many of you will recall, the governor believed that we had a $6 billion problem to solve, and so he is recommending the gross receipts gasoline tax at 6.5%, the vehicle registration fee changes that he proposed last year, a 0.5-cent metro sales tax addition to help fund transit issues, and a general fund increase for Greater Minnesota Transit and safe routes to schools of $13 million. The key here, obviously, the governor's made comments about this proposal, both of these proposals, and particularly with the tax credit proposal, wanted to make sure that any tax credits were focused on middle to lower income families, in particular those families that need child care services, which is a very expensive thing in Minnesota these days, one of the most expensive programs in the country for child care in Minnesota. But in the transportation area, he's obviously mentioned a willingness to be to reach some discussion about other alternatives, but he's waiting to hear other alternatives, and at this point, both of these pieces are based on his 2015 proposals.
And Commissioner, can I ask, I understand that both of these bills are in conference right now, but is there anything different that the governor is proposing this year in the tax and transportation area that is different from what he proposed last year?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I think only federal conformity is the only difference in the tax proposal.
All right. Yeah. Thank you. Okay, please proceed.
In the next area, Mr. Chair, labeled economic opportunity for all, this is both some of the governor's equity proposals and economic opportunities. He's proposing $245 million in additional spending here. First of all, he wants to ensure that every Minnesotan has access to affordable and reliable broadband. If you look at pages 11 through 12, page 16 and page 41, you can see the more detail for these proposals. You know, the governor's proposing $100 million to invest in broadband internet expansion around the state. And this, we believe this funding would actually provide a leverage opportunity for both local and private resources to expand rural broadband and internet access across Minnesota. The governor's also proposing $100 million investment to expand economic opportunities and eliminate disparities for Minnesotans of color across the state. As many of you are aware, there have been hearings about this not that long ago, where we were concerned about the economic disparities that are occurring in our society, where we, even though we see an expanding economy, we see more jobs, we continue to see racial disparity, lack of closing the economic gap for many groups. So the governor has put together a fairly extensive list of equity proposals that we can talk about, but he also wants to make sure that we provide some opportunity for citizens in the community and the legislature to come up with other suggestions, and it's one of the reasons why we left $33 million of this investment unassigned at this point, to get input from Minnesota communities, from the legislature, about how best to proceed. And the final area I'll mention before we get to questions is the local government county program aid, which is $47 million. That's split not quite half and half, but pretty close to 50-50 between local government aid and county program aid. Any questions?
Representative Kahn.
Yeah. Sorry, this probably should have been asked under the first one, but one of the worst decisions I think that we've ever made, and I don't know who was responsible for making for it, was not extending the North Star to St. Cloud. When I look at students around the state and I look at the advantage of connection between students at St. Cloud and students in the Minneapolis area or potential students in both that areas, why can't, and as I understand it, when you look at the, I think the reason we didn't do it at the time was that we weren't eligible for federal funds because of the population issues. I think that's been relaxed. Is the administration looking at doing that and getting us a firm analysis as to what it would cost? I understand that it's much cheaper than almost any other mass transit thing we could possibly do. What's the issue on that?
Commissioner Franz?
Mr. Chair, Representative, you know, I'm not familiar with any plans to immediately extend that line as part of the governor's transportation package. I believe it's not in there, but I certainly appreciate your concerns. And as times change, these federal requirements do change and different opportunities present themselves. So I'm sure that's something we'll be discussing, but I'm not aware of any.
Okay. Well,
Representative
Mr. Chairman, why you rethought of it under the economic opportunity for all part is that was part of the program of the Isaiah group when they were at the legislature. They see that as an important part of the economic opportunity for all. So it's not just a transportation or an education issue. It's also an economic opportunity for all issue, because that's one of the groups most concerned with that. So I would love it brought to the attention, you know, maybe because it's like three things. It's transportation, economic opportunity, and education. No one pays any real attention to it, so I'd love to get that on the agenda somehow.
Representative Mahoney and then Detmer. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have three questions, and one of them the commissioner can't answer, but like Representative Liebling, I'm hoping that this particular the economic development piece comes to the Jobs and Energy Committee, because I have probably an hour's worth of questions. But here's a couple that I think you might be able to answer or give me some indication of where the thought process was. I look at the numbers, and some of them make sense, some of them don't. So can you explain how the executive branch came to the 4.1 million, 8 million, 6 million? How did they spread that out? Where did they come up with their ideas and some of that?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, you mean representative in the equity program area? I'm not sure.
Yes. Yeah, in the equity area, you have Pathways to Prosperity with 4.1 million. Youth at Work is 8 million. I mean, where did those numbers come out of? And are you looking for a different number at the end of the day?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, no, that's a good question. I think, first of all, it was a quite extensive process. A number of these proposals came forward from some of the different agencies in the executive branch, and some of them came from community groups and community members. The goal was to try to make a real difference and try to make this not just be a program, that we have a small isolated program over on the side that we do for equity or expanding economic opportunities. The goal was to present a more comprehensive approach to economic disparities, and that is why we are looking for a different number, so to speak, at the end, and that's why we left some of the money unassigned, because we believe that we can all come together in a better way and address some of these issues. But the problem has been that by piecemealing this and not really developing a comprehensive or a large response, we're not really changing the situation very much. And so the lieutenant governor believed that we need to, in a more direct way, in a larger way, in a very concentrated statement, that we come up with a number of different opportunities that are listed in those pages that collectively we think will make a difference. It's hard sometimes to pull one out versus the other one and say this one's going to make more of a difference than the other one. And part of what we want to try to do is also develop results-based programming so that when we do these programs, we require the people who run the programs to devise measures and results so that we can take a look when we're done and see if they really did help. But so, yes, we're looking for suggestions. Yes, we're looking for other proposals, but we went through a very exhaustive search around the agencies and in the communities to come up with the best starting list that we could to begin this discussion.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Most of what you said, I could go through it. I'll go through it in the Jobs and Energy Committee, but the one thing that kind of caught my ear was when you talked about measurements of outcome measurements, and you asked the programs to design their own outcome measurements, and that's really not their job. That's the executive's job, and that's the legislature's job to actually put in what tells us if they were a success and have an ability to compare apples to apples. And I could ask my colleague on the other side of the table over there how many times we've been told that this job training program or this educational program is, oh my God, the best thing that's ever happened to the world. And it's amazing that you can get 40 particular programs that are the, oh my God, best thing that has ever happened to the world. Just to give you a heads up on where I kind of feel about that. That's a subtle hint, maybe. The other is I would like some direction from the executive branch as we try to work with, I don't have the same problems that other areas of the metro have in my legislative district, but I have significant pockets of poverty. One of the things that I've dealt with is I've taken to looking at census tracts and the rates of poverty and free and reduced lunch of people that live in those census tracts. But the strange problem is once you start looking at census tracts and some of that stuff, you start seeing it around the state. And even in some of our most affluent counties, some of our more prosperous counties, we're starting to see small areas. So this is not a metro issue. This is a statewide issue. And whether it's in southern Minnesota or western or northern or central or the urban areas. So my fear with any of these programs is that they become targeted to one particular area when frankly, we have people of color living in poverty across the state. And we, our charge is to craft this so it serves all of them. And I would really like the executive branch to be engaged and involved in that and not kind of throw it in. Look for suggestions from everybody else, but actually partner with us hand in hand to kind of figure out the best way that we can spend these tax dollars to change people's lives. Because that's what we're here for, is to change people's lives, and I know the governor is too. So,
Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Commissioner Franz. On page 6 of the PowerPoint regarding transportation, your general increase for Greater Minnesota Transit and Safe Routes to School, how much of that is Safe Routes to School?
Mr. Chair, I'll have to get back to you. I don't have that breakdown in my
okay,
notes.
That was my first, Mr. Okay. Chair. My okay. second question, I'm trying to go through the documents here. I don't see any investments into our veterans programs in the governor's budget here. I know I chair the Veterans Division, and there's some real needs out there yet that we haven't addressed. Some of those needs are in the tax bill, the current tax bill. Where is the governor at on veterans issues?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I appreciate the question. I think one of the reasons when we talk about an economy that works for everyone or expanding equity opportunities, whether it's training or education or housing, we really believe that that fits all Minnesotans and obviously includes veterans. And the governor's very concerned about the veterans and in terms of their ability to get jobs, to maintain jobs, to get education and training. And so one of the things that we'll be talking about at MMB is part of the governor's proposal on equity is to increase diversity and inclusion training at and programs at MMB. As the state's largest employer, the governor really wants the state to be not just the largest employer, but the model employer. And part of that really makes sure that we reach out to veterans, to women in some jobs that are traditionally male jobs, to those people with disabilities, to those folks of color. So the key, as kind of following up on Representative Mahoney said, the key really is to make a difference in people's lives and to make sure that we do that in every single way, including veterans and people of color and women in some jobs. So although that's not specifically called out, clearly these programs and our attempt to enhance economic opportunities, enhance equity and diversity and inclusion training applies across the board and with equal fervor to veterans.
Mr. Chair, maybe just a short follow-up. I know the Commander's Task Force has come forward with their legislative priorities, and I think, again, I mentioned some of those are addressed in our tax bill, but I know that there's probably a big request out there right now for more veterans homes. We have 5 veterans homes, and I know there's, I think, 4 communities right now that have a request in, and we know that's also a federal issue because, you know, 65% of that funding for construction of new veterans homes comes from the federal government. So this is something that I know the Commander's Task Force is looking at very carefully. Thank you.
And then, Commissioner, if I could, I don't see any other questions, but on page 45 and at the bottom of this slide, you talk about local government and county program aid of $47 million. But I notice on page 45 that there are no tails on this. This is a one-time increase in government aid, which I guess I don't think normally I've seen that real often. Is the governor anticipating that there's going to be some sort of one-time expenditure that local cities and counties have to deal with in the next year that wouldn't exist in following years? Or why is the governor recommending only this one-time increase?
Mr. Chair, let me back up a little bit. I talk a little bit more about sort of the one-time investment in general and specifically as it relates to local government aid. Part of the governor and lieutenant governor's thinking on this budget was to recognize the economic situation that we were in and that there has been some reduction in the projected economic growth in the future. Clearly, our budget surplus in November of $1.2 billion, now at $900 million, and also a reduction in the next biennium, caused all of us to sit back and say, let's make sure that we're careful and cautious about how we proceed. So the budget, supplemental budget recommendations that we're bringing to you today are really those that we think need to be done this year. And we recognize that we will be putting together biennial budget in the not-too-distant future for the next session. But what we wanted to do in a number of areas, whether it's broadband or in the equity area, or in, for example, cybersecurity, where we even asked for $46 million in cybersecurity investment this session, there is a recognition that we may ask for more in the next biennial budget. But in the local government aid area and the county program aid area, we believe that this was a recognition that there are needs by the cities and counties that we need to address this session. We don't know what's going to happen with the economic situation in November and then next February. It is a little unusual to ask for just a blanket amount with not adding that on for the next session, but we felt that we wanted to be mindful of, let's make the right decisions for what needs to be done this year and this session, and then we'll take a look at what happens in November and February before we put together the biennial budget for next year.
Well, I would agree it is unusual, and I guess I would say that those other items you talk about, such as broadband, are sort of by their nature more discrete project-oriented items, as are the cybersecurity-type items. But anyway, Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just that $47 million split Greater Minnesota, Urban Minnesota, could I just say POTHOLES would be a good use for that $47 million. I think that's a great idea, and I think when we have extra money, and it's never extra money, but our urban areas, our Greater Minnesota centers, the economic centers like Wilmer or Albert Lea or Vailbilt, $47 million doesn't even scratch the surface of the asphalt problems that we have out there, and that is one of the biggest problems as we look forward in the next decade, our infrastructure and how we fix these roads and fix the stuff that's underneath the roads. And Mr. Chair, just what would be really delightful for everyone to see is a cutaway of what's underneath our roads and how many lines there are underneath them, and electrical and sewers and water and gas, and I can name a few more, and what particular cities still have wood pipes that are carrying 2-inch high-pressure gas, and which cities have 2-inch wood water pipes still carrying around. It's an interesting world. We have an infrastructure problem, and this is a smart idea. I wish it was even larger for our cities.
Representative Detmer, did you have a question on that?
Yeah. All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I should have came back to that first question regarding safe routes to school. Were you able to come up with a figure on that, Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative, $2.5 million for safe routes to schools.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I have a question. The $20 million grants to increase higher education completion. I'm looking here at our summary, and I can't seem to find that. Where does that money go? And how is it defined? Who gets the grants?
Mr.
Page
Chair,
16,
yeah, page 16. So that would be through the Office of Higher Education, and one of the concerns that Commissioner Pogemiller has discussed is the graduation rates for students of color at the state colleges. It's about 10 points below that of their white peers. So these grants would help fund research-driven best practices that we believe would help facilitate student retention and completion at these higher education institutions. So the institution that receives the grant money would receive a decreasing percentage of this funding in the future. So this would be an opportunity for this year for these institutions to apply for this money, get it up and running, but then we would not necessarily carry it forward, and they would have to take over in the future. But this is really targeted, it's why it's in the equity package. It's particularly targeted toward increasing the graduation rates of students of color.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I found it now here on page 16. I interpreted it looking at the handout as grants to students, and you're seeing grants to institutions. Thank you.
All right, seeing no further questions on this page, let's go on to the next one.
Mr. Chair, members, I believe we're ready for protecting vulnerable adults and children. This particular slide has about $150 million in additional investments. First of all, one of the concerns we have is the state hospital and mental health.
Excuse me, Commissioner, what page do we start on in the bigger handout? Do you know?
Yes,
that page 18?
18 through 27.
All right.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, for decades we've neglected some of the infrastructure and programming needs at state hospitals and mental health facilities. Clearly, these institutions and these places of treatment have issues regarding safety and treatment. And one of the governor's primary concerns is to make sure that both staff and those clients are being housed safely, and there's public safety that is being maintained. One of the significant investments would be for services at the Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center, the Minnesota Security Hospital in St. Peter, the Minnesota Sex Offender Program, and also some statewide community-based health services. We believe that the improvements in this area would help provide, give them the care that they need while ensuring public safety and in their own safety. The governor is also recommending a 5% increase for primary care and health care providers for services that are provided to medical assistants and Minnesota care enrollees. And finally, the governor would recommend the Minnesota Family Investment Program, MFIP. It would be increased the monthly payments by $100 a month. This increase would help 65,000 children and 29,000 adults. We believe the state assistance for these low-income families has not increased since 1986, and believe we need to make this modest adjustment at this time. And I'm happy for questions.
Well, Commissioner, one thing I've heard from some of my local law enforcement and other local government officials is a concern that with the passage of the 48-hour rule by the legislature a few years ago, that it's become much more difficult to have beds available for people with mental health issues in places like Anoka. And I see this talks about increasing psychiatric beds. Do you have any number in terms of how many new beds would be available as a result of the governor's initiatives across the system by adopting his proposals?
Mr. Chair, I'll let Director Kelly take a look at that. You know the numbers? We don't have those stats. I'm sorry, you wanted to know the number of beds?
Number of beds specifically. And I guess for these questions that, you know, we're asking, that if you don't have an answer, you know, I understand there are a lot of detailed questions. Perhaps you could get back to us, and then if you get back to Mr. Stone, the committee administrator, we can get the answers out to all the members. But I think that's a really important issue, because I have heard, you know, concerns about that issue from a number of local government officials, I think, across the state.
Yes,
and then I guess also I know that there's been a lot of concerns about just the management of the St. Peter Hospital, the Minnesota Security Hospital. We've put a significant amount of money into that in the deficiency bill last year. I want to say an extra $10 million, and now we're asking for like another $24 million. Representative Dean, did you have a question? Representative Dean, I guess first of all, I guess, can you give us a sense of why still more money is going to solve the problem, or what exactly is, are we just hiring more staff, and is that all we need to do, Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, there's more that we need to do, and because this is a highly complex area, I hesitate to get into it. I think Commissioner Piper can, in more detail, describe the issues there. But clearly, the concern about providing a safe environment is important. The concern about making sure we have the right number of employees there, that they're paid adequately. So it's a combination of a number of factors. One of the issues over the last several years has been the funding mechanism for this particular group of people needing services has not been adequate to meet its needs. And so I think what we're asking for here is a way to make sure this funding is adequate for the remainder of this biennium, and we're also asking for some money in the next biennium as well. But we believe it will solve the ongoing funding problems that you mentioned that we discussed last year in the deficiency bill that we passed. So this is an ongoing problem, and I'm sure Commissioner Piper can give the details about the problems.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. And one of the issues that we did have was with the deficiency bill of $11 million. And the committee has followed up with the department and the security hospital and found that, in fact, very little, if any, additional staff is being added at the areas where it was necessary, at the frontline staff positions. that we continue to see an epidemic of overtime at the facilities, and that we just have not added folks at those levels. And we've heard excuses that there's not people willing to do that, they can't fill those positions. But we were very frustrated that we needed this $11 million as an emergency in a deficiency bill, and then talk to folks who are working at the facility and the union representatives, and find, in fact, the working conditions have not improved and the safety conditions have not improved because they just haven't added people with those dollars. But the money's getting spent somehow. So I think that that's a frustration that we continue to have.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I share your concern, and certainly one of the issues that we want to try to work with you and your committee on as this goes through your committee is to make sure that you have an understanding and appreciation for what we think we can do to make to solve those problems for the longer term.
And Commissioner, if I can, I'm sorry, Representative Dean, okay. If I can go to page 25, there are two rather large items here dealing with the Health Care Access Fund, which I was going to possibly get into later, but as long as we're on this, I see that in 2017, it looks like we're taking $74 million from the Health Care Access Fund for one purpose, and then we're refinancing medical assistance with another $51 million. And so this is $125 million this year, and if I remember right, something like $388 million in the following year or the following biennium, which is actually more than is left on the bottom line in 2018-19 with the governor's budget. So the governor's budget shows a surplus in 18-19, but as I understand it, only because we're taking more than that amount of money from the Health Care Access Fund. I guess, can you confirm that and then give me a justification for why we would do this, especially when the provider tax is scheduled to expire at the end of 2019?
Sure, Mr. Chair. I think one of the things I'd like to point out is right now the February forecast for the Health Care Access Fund balance is $610 million for this biennium and is projected to grow to $1.166 billion in the next biennium. So after the changes that you, there are a few other minor changes, but after the major changes that you suggest, and I'll explain both of those in just a moment, of the $130 million this particular biennium and $388 million, it would still leave a balance in the Health Care Access Fund of $618 million at the end of the next biennium. But let me explain those two transfers. The first one that you mentioned was a transfer of $74 million. So this is an update to the Health Care Access Fund transfer to the General Fund for the provider and premium tax expansion. Now, previously to this budget, $48 million per fiscal year was transferred from the Health Care Access Fund to the General Fund as required by statute. So at the inception of this transfer, it reflected the value at that time in 2005 of the premium and the provider tax that were attributable to medical assistance and the general assistance medical care in the General Fund and federal funds. So the value of this transfer amount has not been updated since 2005. While the health care costs that are connected to that have gone up considerably, this proposal would update the value of this transfer to its current actual value, which we believe would be $74 million. So that would transfer Health Care Access Fund $74 million in cost to the General Fund. It would transfer funds to the General Fund. Now, the other one that you mentioned would transfer medical assistance for adults without children, the federal poverty guideline, from the General Fund to the Health Care Access Fund, and that's about $56 million a year. Now, the adults from this were already paid for from the Health Care Access Fund, so prior to medical assistance program eligibility changes that were made in the Affordable Care Act, many of these adults without children were funded through the Health Care Access Fund. So these two changes, we believe, are in line with previous actions from the Health Care Access Fund, provide an opportunity to fund some of these changes in the Department of Human Services area that we feel are critical, and would still provide a balance in the Health Care Access Fund in 18 and 19. Obviously, as you mentioned, there's an issue at the end of 2019 about what's going to happen with the provider tax, but we feel at this time that these transfers make sense given the balance in that fund and given the needs for funding.
Commissioner, is the governor recommending extending the provider tax?
Mr. Chair, we've had a number of discussions about that. I think one of the issues that we believe at this time, that in this session, it's probably not going to be addressed, but I think ultimately we will be taking a look at that, and unless we can find an alternative support for the provider tax, it's something I think we all need to take a look at and decide if that's the way we want to fund some of these costs.
Well, Commissioner, is it fair to say that, leaving aside the carryover from 2017, if we didn't take the money from the health care access fund that the governor is proposing for 18 and 19, but still enacted the rest of his budget, that we'd actually have a deficit for 18 and 19 if we did not take the health care access fund money?
Mr. Chair, clearly the governor's proposal does rely on the assets and the money in the health care access fund. Obviously, we weren't going to access those health care access funds. We'd have to look at our balance differently.
All right. I have Representative Liebling, Dean, and Davids. Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I wanted to comment on what Representative Dean said. We were talking about the Anoka Regional Treatment Center, and this is, we did have a good debate, or not debate, sorry, hearing. We had a good hearing on this whole issue. And during that hearing, I never heard anything about this idea that somehow the funds are being misdirected. This is the first I've heard of it. Now, I don't know if Representative Dean just learned about this since that hearing, but we did spend a whole hearing talking about this when we had the commissioner present, and she could have answered the questions. There was quite a bit of discussion about the fact that there's been very high turnover in that facility and that they've had trouble keeping staff because of the conditions there. And I believe that she said that they feel that they've turned a corner. And so a lot of the money they were requesting was because of safety issues. As most members probably know, they also have some bonding going on at the security, or construction going on at the security hospital to try to alleviate some safety issues there. But I can't sit here and tell you all the details, but I just really wanted to respond because Representative Dean's bringing up a new, what I would call, allegation. And this session already, we've heard some kind of unfounded allegations about money being misdirected. And I think it's really unfair to bring that up in a setting where the person who could answer it really isn't here to respond. So I just wanted to say that there, from, you know, obviously these are very serious problems that have been going on in our whole mental health system. The chair asked where the beds are being added or how many, and I can't tell you how many, but one of the ways that beds are being added is to the 16-bed hospitals that are around the state. They're not working at capacity right now. So a lot of the beds are being proposed to be added in those settings, which are a little bit lower acuity, but one of the proposals is to raise the acuity level of those sites, not probably to the highest level, but nevertheless, to be able to handle more of the more serious patients in those settings. But I think that we really would need to have a discussion with the commissioner so that she could respond. One of the big takeaways for me from that hearing was that there is a working group that, with a lot of different stakeholders, that's been working on this very thorny problem, because it's not only about the number of beds, it's about our whole system capacity and where, how do we get people to be in the appropriate place at the appropriate time. So it's not only about the number of hospital beds, it's also about, as the chair mentioned, the 48-hour rule and how that's impacting things, which has not been altogether a good thing, and a lot of other issues about our whole system. So thank you.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Representative Liebling's comments, I'm not questioning whether or not the money is being spent inappropriately. I'm suggesting that it's being spent inefficiently, because the positions that were meant to be added with those dollars, as a point of fact, aren't there. We've had the passage of many, many months, and the money is just not translating into more professionals taking care of people so that we have the resulting effect of more people with more overtime, more injuries, and more dangerous positions for both residents and for staff. So that is just an undisputable fact that we need to figure out, and I don't really know why that is. Well, and if you'll allow me to finish, Representative Liebling, so that is just a point of fact for that we have to figure out for both Anoka and St. Peter. We just do. But to the commissioner's comment that we're not really sure about what's going to happen to the provider tax at the end of 2019, actually we are. We are. It's current law. It is going away. That was decided. And our laws need to anticipate that we are going to enact the laws that are passed. There's maybe people that want to do things differently down the road, but you know, our staff and our job as legislators is to enact current law, and that is, in point of fact, current law. I would also like to point out that if we were to allow the accumulation of surplus within the healthcare access fund, that would indeed trigger a tax reduction in the 2% provider tax so that it would ratchet down over time. But when the money is taken out of that and we've drained that fund, we don't allow the tax to go down. So every time that we do that, we are in fact raising taxes because that accumulation of funds was designed to wean us off of this provider tax. So that we don't keep helping ourselves to these dollars. As to the one-time appropriation that's always built into the forecast, I always wondered why that was there, why we just automatically transfer money out of the healthcare access fund to the general fund. And I was told that at one point before I got here was focused on that, that they needed some money to balance the budget, so they did it, and it was left in the riders, and it just keeps continuing on, and that's why we do that. So it's an error to leave it there, so I don't know that we necessarily have to scale things for inflation, but if we do scale things for inflation, it probably shouldn't be an error in a previously passed budget. So we do really have to focus in on this the healthcare access fund. This is a parallel budget that causes... it's a temptation both under Republicans and Democrats to help ourselves to that money that has been used to balance other budgets over time. It's being done again, and shame on us for doing it, and it's just another reason why we need to remove ourselves from this parallel budget into the future.
Representative Davids.
I'll pass, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to respond to what Representative Dean said about the staffing. And, you know, we don't need to drag this out too much. But, I don't know that it's a fact that staffing hasn't improved. We had the folks here representing the union. We had the commissioner. We had a lot of the people who work on this issue. And I don't think Representative Dean brought this up. And that would have been the perfect time to discuss it. So... you know, I think if that is indeed a problem, then we need to deal with it, but we should deal with it with the appropriate people in the room. Thank you.
Commissioner, next page.
Just a couple more, Mr. Chair. Safety and security is a label. The next one, our counties are currently responsible for the entire cost providing courthouse safety and security. The governor recommends a one-time funding of $20 million to courthouse safety and security improvements. The Chief Justice of the Minnesota Supreme Court would establish an advisory panel of justice partners and county government officials to develop grant criteria, accept applications, review proposals, and make grant awards. The Department of Corrections is responsible for the safety and security of inmates.
Excuse me, do you have a page on this, Commissioner?
Page 41.
All right,
and
thank
for
you.
Courts. And pages 5 through 6, Mr. Chair, for corrections.
Okay. Please proceed. Thank you.
In the corrections area, the governor is committed to ensuring sufficient resources to maintain core responsibilities and while providing evidence-based programming that will help reduce recidivism. This increase in funding will provide safe staffing ratios at all times, 24/7 nursing coverage at four additional facilities, improve chronic care and infectious disease management, especially for hepatitis C, and provide treatment for those offenders coming to prison with severe and persistent mental illness. And the last item I want to hit on this slide is cybersecurity. I mentioned it earlier. Every day or minute, agency defends the state against thousands of attacks against our technology infrastructure. We need to ensure our systems have the most up-to-date software to protect against these attacks. This investment will do several things. First, Minute will improve data storage security, acquire additional security software and tools, and provide targeted support to small and mid-sized agencies. And secondly, Minute will make security upgrades for the backbone of the state's financial and human capital software at MMB and key systems at corrections and education that have fallen woefully behind the times. Any questions before we move on? Mr. Chair.
I guess, Commissioner, I'd have a question, and that is I think that in our budget this last year, we adopted the governor's recommendations for corrections and how much money he asked for over the next 2 years. And given the governor's recommendation for funding was adopted, why are we seeing line items like this asking for additional employee compensation for not only 2017, but for 2016, as well as some of these other items in here if we enacted the governor's recommendations last year?
Mr. Chair, I appreciate your question. I mean, this really is an additional request based upon the change in the contract rates that were negotiated on behalf of the state this last year, and also health care costs for some of the inmates. So this is an additional request based upon employee costs to man those situations 24/7.
Well, Commissioner, so when you talk about employee costs, you're talking about the contract was decided last year, or are you talking about the new contract that's up for settlement? And if you're talking about the new contract that's up for settlement, are you saying that the governor settled for more than was anticipated last year?
Mr. Chair, this would be for those contracts that were negotiated that are in front of this legislature for approval this year. We anticipated and tried to incur additional compensation costs of about 1.8%. The contracts were negotiated at 2.5%. And so many agencies are able to adjust to and make changes to accommodate that change. But 24/7 facilities like corrections, it's pretty difficult to do that because you have to have 24/7 coverage. Sometimes you can make savings in an agency by holding on to vacancies for a little bit for a while to allow some of your employee costs to make up for that difference. But corrections is simply not able to make up for that difference because they have to have 24/7 coverage.
Okay, so Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner. Commissioner, I serve on the subcommittee employee relations, and we saw those contracts come through, and I have done some comparisons against the budget items that you and many agencies had last year, and it appears very clearly that you negotiated contracts which were richer or required actually more taxpayer dollars than you had budgeted for throughout the budget process. In as far as I can tell, every one of the budget areas that were passed as part of the budget last year. So what you're saying to us is you budgeted for a certain amount, you went and negotiated a higher amount, and now you are going to come back and ask the legislature to take even more taxpayer money to pay for these higher negotiated, higher agreed upon amounts that in a cursory way would suggest maybe there wasn't a lot of real strong negotiation happening, especially in light of the fact that there was a hardline budget number that you had used. So is that what, are we going to see more bills come forward and once again labeled as what were they called, emergency or deficiency? I labeled them mismanagement bills last year, and Commissioner, if that's what we're going to see again, I think the label would be proper again. But I'm curious if you're going to bring more quote deficiency bill proposals forward to this body.
So, Commissioner, if we don't fund this, are we going to see a deficiency request from the administration next year?
Mr. Chair, and certainly in the corrections area, you probably would. One of the issues that we face in negotiating contracts, and I'll take issue with your characterization of the negotiations, Representative, and that is that we have to make the budget for the biennium before we negotiate the contracts in June. So last year in 2015, the budget, biennial budget, was passed during the session, and then finally in the special session. But the contract negotiations begin really in June. We get prepared before that point, but the actual final negotiations are concluded in June for AFSCME and MAPE, and then the other unions follow up on that. So it's extremely difficult to, in fact, impossible to anticipate what that final contract amount may be. Now, this is the way it's been for a number of years. I'm not saying it's the best way to do it, but on the other hand, it doesn't make sense from our point of view to try to put some other number in there that we think might be the final result. We enter those negotiations with the idea of trying to bargain in a very effective way and try to reach a contract negotiation that's fair to the union, to the employees, and that's fair to the state. In this particular instance, we had budgeted about 1.8% increase in costs for employee costs, and the contracts were negotiated, as you know, at 2.5%. And as I mentioned earlier, many of the agencies, and our agency, for example, many agencies are able to withstand that change and variance and balance their budget accordingly. But some agencies, like corrections, don't have the ability to just hold open positions when someone leaves to try to make up for the salary difference. They actually have to have people there 24/7. So this particular request is a recognition that in this area, the 24/7 area of corrections, we need people there 24/7, and we need to make some adjustments to those compensation packages, or we may in fact see a deficiency next year.
Representative Cornish. Representative Driscoll, did you have a question or a follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner. You and I do disagree on this, and as a matter of fact, there were very large increases negotiated by your agency with each of these contract groups, even larger ones the year before. And so given the ability to look at history, if you were going to properly budget during the last session for the biennium, you would be most informed by history by having used a significantly larger number, if indeed that was what you were looking to do. So, Commissioner, we don't agree on this. Thank you.
Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair and members, this is just the housekeeping thing. I was just wish in the future when you address us with this script, if you could just substitute a word, new money disbursements in place of investments, because investment is kind of an interpretation that not all of us have in each one of these things. So, thank you.
Next page, Commissioner.
The next, Mr. Chair and members, the paid leave is found on page 28. Fraud for the Department of Revenue is found on page 40, and the judge's retirement plan is found on page 31. These are just some additional investments that I wanted to discuss with you before we close. The governor, as you know, has made a proposal to increase paid parental leave for all state employees that would cost about $2 million on an annual basis going forward. The fraud investigation is a request by the Department of Revenue for $2.6 million to fight fraud that they are experiencing at this time, and I'm sure Commissioner Bowerly will be able to describe that before Chair David's committee. And then the judge's retirement plan is one where we were concerned about the retirement plan that has about only a 53.3% funded ratio right now. We want to it is a very small number of people in that plan, and we're recommending an annual $6 million to improve the long-term sustainability of that plan in order to honor the commitments we made to these judges. And finally, the bonding recommendations, just want to make it clear that we've, in order to fund the bonding recommendations, we have both cash in the bonding bill and the amount necessary to cover that bonding bill debt capacity. Do you have the breakdown of that, Dr. Kelly?
Mr. Chair and members, it's $8 million for debt capacity, and the balance of the $21 million is for cash in the bonding bill for labs, for agency relocation, for capital security improvements on the Capitol grounds.
And then
All right.
The final slide or two really just are just summaries of the $900 million forecast that we all know is there. The governor's recommending that we spend $698 million, leaving $202 million on the bottom line. And the final slide shows what happens in the 18-19, where we would propose spending $817 million in that biennium, but leaving $571 million on the bottom line.
Okay, then just a couple of questions from me. I guess first to this last slide. I know that we don't do this, Commissioner, as a matter of formal policy, but given underneath current law the provider tax is going away, has the department done any sort of a, like, back-of-the-envelope forecast to say where we'll be in 2021, given we will no longer under current law have the provider tax? I mean, what would our tails look like, our budget look like in 2021 without that?
Mr. Chair, well, first of all, as you may recall, last session was a major report. Was the last session or the session before that? We did a major report looking just exactly as you're saying what's going to happen, because as you all know, the funding mechanism, the Health Care Access Fund, has been the subject of many changes in law, both federal and state. So the reimbursement procedures, the amount of money coming in, the amount of money going out has changed dramatically over the last several years. But we are looking at the long-term effect. We don't have it in front of us, but we could present to the committee sort of the long-term funding effect of the Health Care Access Fund, assuming that it is sunsetted, as Representative Dean mentioned, in 2019.
Yeah, if you could get back to us with any sort of a, you know, rough forecast of what 2021 looks like with that change in law that is in law, that would be interesting to see. Then I just a couple of other questions. The fraud investigation for $2.6 million, a lot of times when we have allocated additional money to the Department of Revenue, there's been a forecast of additional revenues coming in. Is there any sort of additional revenue tied to this appropriation, saying that, well, if we do this, we get back, I don't know, $10 million more or whatever in additional revenues, or isn't there anything like that with this?
Mr. Chair, there is not any estimated revenue with this. One of the concerns the Department of Revenue has is that the whole issue of identity theft and IT security issues have really heightened the last several years. So they believe that we need additional technology and staffing resources in order to enable to identify and reduce tax fraud. So at this point, this is trying to protect the income flow that we're now receiving from our taxpayers to make sure that we get what people pay in and that they're protected. So this is not a program designed to increase audits or that kind of a situation where you increase revenues.
Okay, and I guess finally, Commissioner, you know, I wanted to get into the debt capacity issue, and just for a couple minutes, maybe we'll do that. If people see the debt capacity forecast that's in your packet, you know, for many years, Commissioner, I remember seeing sort of two different debt capacity forecasts, the one based on the threshold of personal income, which once upon a time was 3%, now is 3.25%, and underneath this it says we have a, you know, debt capacity of $968 million, and then one which has traditionally the debt capacity number two shown a capacity of many billions of dollars more than that. I guess what do you believe our debt capacity is at this point based on the guidelines that we have traditionally set forth?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure what you mean by what our debt capacity is in terms of how much we could bond for at this particular time, or I'm not sure I understand.
Yeah, at this point, and traditionally my recollection going back to the years when I was bonding chair years ago is that we have said our debt capacity is for our general obligation bonding is the lower of debt capacity number one or number two, which in this case would be $968 million. And now I see we've got debt capacity guideline number three, and I've heard something in the neighborhood of $3 billion as an estimated debt capacity. I guess what does the department believe we can bond for in this bonding bill without exceeding our debt capacity guidelines?
Mr. Chair, thank you. I apologize for not understanding your question first. One of the issues with the first guideline talks about those GO bonds that have been actually sold. Yeah. So that's the reason it's listed as $900 million. It doesn't. So, for example, if we had a bonding bill this year, not all of those bonds would be sold in the next several months. And so we believe that there is a debt capacity of $3.2 billion because it normally takes anywhere from 3 to 4 to 5 years for a bonding bill for all of those bonds to actually be sold. In order for that to count against that first guideline, they have to be sold. And so that is part of the reason why the governor recommended $1.4 billion in his bonding bill, but we actually have a larger capacity in terms of the amount of bonds that are actually sold compared to the total personal income in the state of Minnesota.
Well, Commissioner, haven't we traditionally used the debt capacity guideline number one as our limit in the past year so that we would have said that $968 million in this case is our debt capacity for our GO bonding for this year?
Mr. Chair, no. The first debt capacity only deals with those bonds that are sold. So we would always have said that you can issue and sell $900 million worth of bonds this year. But if you're not going to issue and sell $900 million of bonds, if you follow the typical pattern, you can issue and sell over the next 4 or 5 years $3.2 billion worth of bonds. We would obviously not recommend that. But the nature of that first limit is simply a limit on the number of bonds sold in the market.
So are you saying, Commissioner, that we could issue $3.2 billion of GO bonds this year and still be within our debt guidelines?
Mr. Chair, yes. The authorized, if they were authorized, but not sold.
Well, Commissioner, I would just say that this is greatly at variance with my past recollection of our state's practices. And I guess I'd just leave it at that. Representative Carlson, and then I do still want to try to fit Representative Neuberger's bill in here. Representative Carlson.
Well, just listening to the discussion, Mr. Chairman, we always meter out the sale of those bonds. And I think that's what the Commissioner is saying, that what you authorize is one question, and that's been our long history. And then they'll determine, depending on the status of the various projects, the sale will probably be in July for a bond issue this year. And they're continually metering that out over time. And so when he referenced 4 to 5 years, that's probably for a big project, how long it might take issuing those bonds over a period of time.
Representative Carlson, I think I'm well aware of what he's saying, and I think I'm also well aware that that's different than the way we've used to do it. I think he's moving the goalposts into a new stadium. But anyway, Representative Davids and Gunther. Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to go back, if I could, just for a second, to some comments the Commissioner made regarding the Department of Revenue and what they're looking at for cybersecurity, if you will. Just to let members know, I have spent quite a bit of time with Commissioner Bowerly on this, and refunds have been slowed up a bit. And I'm encouraging her to keep those slow. And the reason they're slow is because they have to check everyone to make sure that who's applying for this refund is the person that's applying for the refund. The crooks are getting very, very creative right now. And I commend Commissioner Bowerly for slowing it down a little bit just to make sure to verify that the refunds are going where they're supposed to go. This is a huge problem, and it's getting worse. And so if refunds are a little bit slower than normal, I think it's wise to do that to make sure that they're going to the right person, because we could be talking about billions of dollars going out to people that don't have these refunds coming. It's pretty frightening out there right now. And on CSI cybersecurity, the other night they had something kind of like this going on, so we got to watch for it.
Okay, I'm going to recognize Representative Gunther, and then I'm going to shift over to Representative Neuberger's bill. Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just out of curiosity, can you help me out? You say if we have a bill for $3 billion for bonding bill this year, we won't let the bonds out all this year, so we have more capacity. How about in previous years? Aren't those bonds being let out on later dates? And doesn't that kind of break the bank a little bit?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, we follow that very closely. That's part of the prediction, is not only estimating what's going to be newly authorized, but what is also becoming sold based on prior legislatures. But remember, every year we're also retiring bonds at the same time. So you have a number of factors going on all at the same time. You have new bonds that are issued, authorized for the first time this year, that won't be sold for the next, all of them, the next 3 or 4 years. You've got some bonds from 2 or 3 years ago that will be sold this year, but you also have many bonds that will be paid off. And that's part of what guideline number 3 makes sure that we pay them off over a particular point of time.
Representative Gunther.
I think he's a bigger gambler than I am.
Well, Commissioner France, Budget Director Kelly, thank you for your testimony today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Neuberger. Members, while Representative Neuberger comes down, I'll move that House File 333 be referred to the General Register. And members, I know that in some area ways this is a controversial bill, but there is a new fiscal note that shows zero fiscal cost. This bill did pass as part of the Jobs and Economic Development Finance Bill this last year, and so I guess I would normally want to give it more discussion. We can go over the noon hour a little bit, but I feel it's, you know, not, since we've already heard it and we have a zero fiscal note, I guess I didn't think it maybe needed a great deal of discussion. But Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, being that you made the motion, I'd like to request a roll call.
All right. Roll call on House File 333. Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I, in respect to your time and the committee's time, I'll be brief here. Simply put, a few years ago, President Obama had released a federal mandate that orders states to reduce their carbon outputs. Minnesota's mandate was 42%. We are one of the top eight states in the country that for percentage reductions. This plan is called the 111D plan. It's very complex. There's a lot of moving parts to it. Simply put, what House File 333 does is it requires a legislative approval of any plan that is submitted before it's submitted to the federal government. So when this plan is created in conjunction between the MPCA and Commerce, that it would come back to us, the elected representatives, to vote yes or no on the plan. That's it in a very, very simple nutshell. Again, Mr. Chair, the and members, the fiscal impact is zero, and I appreciate your time.
And I understand that we have one individual that wanted to testify against the bill. Is that individual here?
Mr. Chairman.
Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
My name is David Thornton. I'm Assistant Commissioner at the Pollution Control Agency. I'll be very brief. Last year we opposed this bill, and we still oppose it. We believe that this is an appropriate administrative function, like many similar actions that we do under the Clean Air Act. EPA establishes standards, and states and agencies like ours use administrative process to develop plans and rules and submit the plans to EPA. So we don't typically bring things like this to the legislature. We don't think it's necessary to do that this time. We have a very extensive input process underway where we're getting input from stakeholders and citizens, and it's a very transparent process, and we think it's working very well.
Thank you, sir. All right, I see Representative Wagenius, Kahn, and Hornstein. Representative Wagenius.
All right, I thought I would be last, but let me go first.
Do you want to be last?
Sure.
All right, Representative Kahn.
Well, Mr. Chairman, the problem that I have with this, and I guess I would like to, I have not looked at what's listed in this as published in the Federal Register on June 18th, and I can't believe any member of this committee has, but I may be corrected if I'm wrong on that. And one of the problems that I've been working on a lot is the difficult issue of the people who have a lot of general information in the legislature dealing with in-depth science issues, which I assume that this proposed rule and the docket has a lot of really in-depth science issues. And So the idea of making some kind of sort of emotional decision on something that requires a large amount of in-depth understanding of science is something I think we ought to be very careful of. And just the fact that we're passing, I don't know how long I'm not on the other committee, and maybe people who are on will speak to it, but we're certainly not spending any time on this today, and the amount of time I would like to spend on it before making a decision, and I think that's part of the problem with passing this bill on at this time.
Representative Hornstein.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And you had mentioned, Representative Neuberger, about the complexity of this, and that's precisely the issue, is that there is a lot of complexity, and it's science-oriented, it's data, and I think this is the whole issue that we've had with the challenges in terms of responding to climate change, is that we've subverted essentially a scientific issue to politics. And I think that's wrong, and you know, we should be letting the PCA and the scientists there do their job.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Neuberger. You know, some of these things around this table and this chamber here, this building, kind of blend in. So maybe you can clarify some things for me. I believe last year, one of the governor would not accept this particular language and held it up as one of the reasons that he might veto the jobs bill. And again, I don't want to go over the Tomasoni Garofalo Conference Committee from last year. But if I remember right, and I'm just top of my head here, wasn't your bill scaled back to be a report back to the legislature?
Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You are correct, Representative Mahoney. That was part of the agreement that was reached between the conferees and the governor's office. This is an important issue, and it was agreed that this would be simply a review that would be brought before the legislature, but we would have no input. This legislative body would have no input as to the actual to the plan. We would just be given a review, and that's what we would be given. Again, what this bill does is it requires us to give legislative approval, and that's why we're here.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I take it you've been in deep conversations with the governor's office, and you've come to agreement with the governor's office, and they won't veto this particular bill?
Representative Neuberger.
Representative Mahoney, I can't speak to that. I am not in deep conversations with the governor's office.
So, Mr. Chair.
Representative Mahoney.
Again, we are just going through the motions here while we just kind of wait for the train wreck at the end of session.
Well, Representative Mahoney, I don't know that that is a... I guess that's a rhetorical question. Representative Albright. Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Since this is not intended to be a review, and as you said, it's intended to be an approval, so the proposal comes to the legislature, and the legislature then, it seems to me, has a choice to amend it or approve it, one, amend it, two, or just not act, three. Am I getting that correct?
Representative Neuberger.
At this time, you are.
Did you say I am getting it correct?
Neuberger.
Representative Wagenius, at this time, you're making a fair assumption.
Okay, so if we have the option, and if you've written it in here that we have the option that nothing has to be done, that the legislature can choose not to approve it, then you are creating essentially a legislative veto. And our Constitution very clearly says, and I got it out because I thought this question would come up, this is Article 3, and it says no person or persons belonging to or constituting one of these departments, that's the legislature, the executive, or the judiciary, shall exercise any of the powers properly belonging to either of the others, except in instances expressly provided in the Constitution. There is no express provision in our Constitution for a legislative veto. This is a power grab. No more, no less. And if you want a power grab, it seems to me that you should propose a constitutional amendment.
Response, Representative Neuberger?
Mr. Chair, I think that I do not agree with Representative Wagenius's assertion of this situation. She's clearly entitled to her opinion. My opinion is different. Given that the purview of this committee is not policy, but it's finance, it's ways and means. Here's the bill. How are we going to pay for it? That's what I'm here for. I welcome the debate on this topic. We will hear it for second reading, and we'll hear it again for hopefully for third. We've already debated this bill, and you were there, Representative Wagenius. We've debated this bill three times in committee, and we've also debated the policy components of this at least once on the floor when there was a motion to re-refer it before it ended up here. If you want to have that policy debate, I welcome that, but at this time, given the purview of this committee, I would like to stick strictly within the purview of the committee and stick to the financial aspects of it.
All right. Members, we are running over. I think I'd like to recognize Representative Carlson for a last question, and then we'll vote. Representative Carlson.
Well, Mr. Chairman, mine isn't a question. I was just going to, when you said one person had requested to testify, had there been more time, there would have been more testimony that would like to have come forward. I just wanted to make that clear.
Okay, and that's a fair statement. Representative Carlson had talked to me and said that there were other people also, but given this is really a finance committee and there's now a zero fiscal note, I guess I wasn't thinking it was really appropriate to have more people testify on it. Representative Wagenius, do you really need to ask another question?
Well, it's not another question, but if there's a constitutional issue here, that is presumes that we will have to pay for an argument before the courts. There is a constitutional question here. I know that Representative Neuberger does not want to recognize it. I wouldn't if I was him either. But it's true. And this is a legislature that has always said we abide by our Constitution.
Well, Representative Wagenius, I think I would just say that it's a, you know, everyone's got their own views of the Constitution and what is constitutional or not. And any bill that we pass here is subject to a lawsuit, which is why we pass an appropriation for the Attorney General to defend us. We don't have a specific appropriation in every single bill that we pass in the event that it might be sued, and that's just a convention that we've adopted.
Well, Mr.
Representative Kahn.
Well, the point that Representative Wagenius is making is that there isn't a zero fiscal impact. To do this action may be a zero fiscal impact, but the costs that it may cost us in terms of energy usage or in terms of a constitutional challenge does not mean that there's a zero fiscal impact.
Okay.
Thank you.
Members, seeing no further discussion, the clerk will take the roll on the bill. Chair will renew his motion that House File 333 be referred to the General Register.
Knobloch?
Aye.
Albright?
Aye.
Anderson? Carlson?
No.
Cornish?
Aye.
Dean?
Yep.
Davids?
Aye.
Dittmer?
Aye.
Drazkowski?
Aye.
Garofalo. Gunther.
Aye.
Hackbarth.
Aye.
Hamilton. Hillstrom. Hornstein.
No.
Kahn.
No.
Liebling.
No.
Loon. Mahoney.
No.
McNamara. Murphy.
No.
Nernes.
No. I mean, yes.
Pawlowski.
Yes.
Poppy?
Aye.
Torkelson?
Aye.
Erdahl?
Aye.
Wagenius?
No.
There being 14 ayes and 7 nays, the bill is referred to the General Register. Members, With that, we are recessed until after session. I'll make an announcement as to the time we're coming back on the floor. And we'll be in this room 200. Thank you.
Legislative authority. On to page 2 for the highlights. There's a series of planning activities that this bill allows, including but not limited to reviewing existing statutes, rules, and procedures, analyzing vendor contracts, computer operations in order to be in compliance with the Real ID platform, reviewing and seeking implementation guidance and communications from the Department of Homeland Security, also developing approaches to safeguard all of our data to maximize the privacy and protection of data concerning all Minnesota applicants. Furthermore, we're asking for an itemization of costs for the Real ID, including what to do with the driver's license for the people that are age 65 years of age and older. Additionally, we're asking for two different tiers, a single tier pricing and also a two-tier licensing program. Also, a legislative report due by the end of this month, March 31st, 2016, is required to come back to a variety of committees, all the committees that have worked on this bill. And lastly, the summary of the planning activities and fiscal impacts. At any given time, a variety of committees can ask for the commissioner and the Department of Public Safety to present both written and orally any activities they have undercovered, all of their progress, and all of their data. And then lastly, the extension to comply. It's important with this bill that we get an extension from the Department of Homeland Security. So our regular, while we review this and determine what path we're going to go forward and get a final end product, that the existing driver's license are able to be used in military establishments and federal buildings. And we're asking that the governor and the legislature seek an extension from the Department of Homeland Security for an immediate extension until the result of our final product. Mr. Chairman, that is a summary of the bill.
And members, there is a fiscal note in your packets, and I would direct your attention to it because while we often get fiscal notes that say zero, and we occasionally get fiscal notes where the department says for various reasons they can't determine a cost, I think this is the first one I've ever seen where they have said we will not give you a cost because we're prohibited by law from doing so. Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, I assume that the debate that we had dealing with the data practices on the House floor, now that it's just a planning process, is no longer a relevant debate, at least until something else is introduced as a second bill. Because as I read this, then it's, and as was pointed out by the author, we'll need a second bill then for actual implementation, which that then should go to civil law, I would assume, before it would ultimately come to appropriations. But my question is, maybe of you, Mr. Chairman, or one of the staff, the process, being that we're passing this now and asking them to go through a planning process, and it was indicated that, I think you said, Representative Smith, that this was to be fully ready by October 1st, how that's going to work with our legislative timelines, because we're going to have to, they're going to have to go through the planning process, and then a bill is going to have to be introduced, and I'm just thinking of the timeline before adjournment so that we can, in fact, meet that goal of October 1st.
Well, Representative Carlson, if you look on page 2, line 34, you'll see that actually the Commissioner of Public Safety is required to submit a report by March 31st. And I've questioned Representative Smith on whether that's, you know, really a reasonable timetable, and he can answer for himself. But I guess I've gotten the understanding that, yes, it is, that they can give us some of the additional information we would need that we're essentially prohibited by law from having and from them even putting together for us. that we can get that within a few weeks, and I would anticipate then that once we have that information, there will be a new bill put together and introduced that, making use of that information, gives us the opportunity to act on it before the end of session.
And Mr. Chairman, that's why I raised the question, as you just said, hopefully in a few weeks, and we only have a few weeks. But our first deadline is April 1st, so if this comes on the 31st, that puts us on a pretty fast track.
Well, I think, Representative Carlson, it is an important bill, and I know that I think everyone from both parties believes it is. I guess we'll have to see when they get us the information and what sort of procedural things may need to be done in order to get the bill enacted, but I anticipate that we can get information on this soon and that we will then act on it quickly.
Yeah, because Mr. Chairman, if it follows the traditional process, you know, your Transportation Committee has an interest in it, Data Practices Committee has an interest in it, and then obviously Ways and Means. So you'd have at least those three committees within that short timeline when the report comes in on the 31st. I'm very supportive of the goal of getting this ready by October 1st, because a lot of people, Mr. Chairman, and maybe everybody in the committee understands it, but there's been so much publicity about boarding aircraft. Now we've got 4 years on that, but it's already partially implemented if you wanted to visit for some reason federal property. My daughter-in-law asked about that. Our grandson is in the Marines, and he's coming back to North Carolina for some additional training, and she wants to go down and visit him, and so she asked, well, will I be able to get on the base? And I'm not sure if she could or not.
Well, my
at this point, but my whole point is that part of it is implemented already. In terms of the requirement to have a real ID. So I'm all for trying to get it done by October 1st. It's just I'm interested in the timeline within the legislative process. But thank you, and good luck.
Thank you. And I guess I understand, Representative Carlson and committee members, that if you look at page 3, section 3, that upon the enactment of this bill, we'll actually be requesting from the federal government an extension that would allow, before we do the rest of the implementation and passing new bill, would allow people to, say, for example, visit military bases based on their current license. But Representative Smith, perhaps you can speak a little bit more to this, since you're more expert on it than I am.
Mr. Chairman, Representatives, we are concerned about the timing, which is one reason why we're accepting the Senate language in the interest of having this move forward, to give the Department as much time as possible to comply with the March 31st date. I have been in correspondence with the Governor's office, and there is some concern about that. But in the interest of time, in hopes that we could possibly make the October 1st date of 2016, we're going to go forward, and if there's information that is partial by the 31st, or if they're going to be a little bit need a little bit more time, I gave the assurance as the author that we were just interested in having this move forward in the most expedited fashion possible. So with that being said, really in the essence of time, I think it's important that we keep that date in there so we can move forward as fast as we can, get the information. Once this bill is passed, as the chairman mentioned, we will be able to ask for an extension from the federal government so the regular driver's license can get into military installations, which is very important to so many of our constituents. And then, you know, then we can work on the initial bill for the remaining part of the session.
Yeah, and Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith, it was my understanding that that part has already been implemented. So I don't know what an extension would mean to get on federal property, but maybe a request for an extension would work. But I thought that went into effect January 1st.
Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, currently we do not have the authority for that. The passage of this bill, we are very hopeful that the Department of Homeland Security will allow an extension, not an extension for the Real ID license, but they will allow our regular driver's card that we have now, allow access to the military installations and certain government buildings.
And I think, Representative Chairman, Representative Smith, the key word there was when you said hopefully. you know, once they've already implemented it, is my point, it may be difficult to get them to offer an extension on something that they've already, since January 1st, as I understand it, been requiring. But maybe with a bit of luck, they'll do that. I hope they do, because there will be people, my daughter-in-law perhaps included. The latest was that he may not come back from Okinawa quite as soon as originally planned, for whatever reason.
He's going to Okinawa.
No, he's in Okinawa.
What about her? Is she going to go visit him in Okinawa?
No, she was going to visit him in North Carolina when he was back for some additional training. That's getting into a family issue of... The family has no control over it. It's the United States Marines that determines when he comes and goes. But at any rate, maybe we'll find out more as it moves along about whether we can get an extension so people can get on a military base until October the 1st is what the question is, with a Minnesota driver's license.
Any other questions for Representative Smith? Representative Smith, any other comments on the bill?
No, Mr. Chairman. Representatives, I hope ask for your support. Thank you.
Well, members, with that, I will renew my motion that Senate File 1646 be referred to the General Register. All in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Senate File 1646 is referred to the General Register. And with that, members, seeing no other business before the committee, we are adjourned.